Welcome, everybody. It's good to see you this evening. Welcome to this lecture to commemorate the memory of Professor Fred Halliday, a dear friend who was a pillar of the IR department here of the school and a pioneer of the discipline of international relations. And I know Fred would have been absolutely delighted with the topic of the talk, the lecture this evening. It's going to be delivered by Professor Hatsue Shinohara, who is based at the Graduate School of Asia Pacific Studies at Waseda University, Waseda being one of Japan's oldest universities, going back to the Meiji era, and a fascinating history in itself. Professor Shinohara is currently based in Venice as a visiting fellow and has just come over for this. As a result, she has got a terrible cold, I'm afraid, and so I really admire her for managing to make it here, and you will probably have to excuse a few coughs. I, too, have a very bad cold. Who hasn't at the moment? So we're all going to be coughing together, I think. But Professor Shinohara is a specialist in international relations, international history, history of Japan, U.S. relations, and law and politics. And I got to know her through developing interdepartmental partnership that we have now between GSAPS and the IR department here. I think we're in about our fifth year now, and we've been sending PhD students backwards and forwards. We're also beginning to develop some joint research amongst faculty, and that's all extremely exciting. But what really blew my mind about Professor Shinohara was her book, published by Cambridge in 2012, in American International Lawyers in the Interwar Years, Forgotten Crusade. Well, I need not say how much looking at the interwar years kind of resonates with what's happening at the moment. We're all drawing parallels. I don't think that's what Professor Shinohara is going to do today, although we may do that in the Q&A. But also, of course, we are still in the centenary of World War I, and so I think this should also be seen as part of the school's activities to commemorate World War I and think back to that period. But especially, what really struck me about it was that it doesn't just look at the American lawyers in the interwar war period. It also looks at the Japanese lawyers, and that I found absolutely fascinating. I mean, I think it's a major contribution to getting away from the Eurocentric sort of bias that we have when we look at international relations. So although most of the book is looking at the U.S. lawyers, it was extremely important what you said, I think, about the Japanese lawyers as well. And I really recommend the book highly to you. It's very readable, extremely interesting, extremely well-researched, thorough. So I won't say any more about that because I'll hand over in a minute to Professor Shinohara. I have to make a few of the usual practical points. Please put your phones on silent because you can Twitter if you wish. There should be a hashtag up there somewhere. The lecture will be recorded. But you can't assume it will be recorded. It should be recorded. At the end of this, we will have a reception in the senior common room on the fifth floor, to which you're all invited to come along for a glass of wine. Okay, so I think I'll now hand over, and if you'll speak for around about 50 minutes or an hour or something, then we'll have question and answer after that, and we'll finish at 8 o'clock. So I'd like to give a very warm welcome to Professor Shinohara. It's up to you whether you're more comfortable. You can either stand or sit.
And also the slide, you know.
Ah, controller.
Okay, yes, slide controllers. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, distinguished colleagues of the London School of Economics. It is my great and perhaps for me the greatest honor imaginable to have this opportunity to speak on the occasion of the Fred Halliday Memorial Lecture. I am very grateful to the Department of International Relations at the LSE, and I'm glad to be able to honor the memory of late Fred Halliday, former professor of the LSE. In particular, I'm very grateful to Professor Christopher Hughes, former head of the Department of International Relations, who offered the opportunity. Initially, as he just said, Professor Hughes and I met on the occasion of an administrative matter concerning a student exchange program between the LSE and Waseda University, when I myself was at the time dean of the Graduate School of Asia Graduate School of Asia Pacific Studies. The exchange program has been successful so far, and in fact, one of my former students from China who participated in the program and studied British naval history in the interval year here at the LSE is now back in China, having taken up a position at the prestigious think tank in Beijing. So we're very happy about the development of this exchange program. And now, upon this occasion, I am very happy to see the relationship that started with the student exchange program developing more fully to include a research project between two schools. Last spring, Professor Hughes spent a month in Tokyo at Waseda University and delivered a lecture at our department. In addition, we discussed the possibility of developing our shared research interests into a concrete research project. Again, my sincere thanks to the LSE and to Professor Hughes, and I would like to express again my a sense of honor at being able to speak here in memory of the late Professor Halliday. Now, then let's move on to today's lecture. The title of my lecture is entitled as International Norm Change, the Outlawry of War in the Interwar Years. When I was looking over the slides and preparing for the lecture this afternoon, another kind of subtitle popped up in my mind, which is the joy of empirical research and promise of multidisciplinary research. That's a kind of another theme which underpins today's lecture. Okay, so specifically today, I would like to talk about why norm change on the legal status of war became possible in the interwar years, and the two other kind of sub-themes. Theoretical implications of my work for the study of international relations. Because this is the Department of International Relations, and I kind of sort of suggested that, and I like to take interdisciplinary approach, so I came to sort of wonder if what I did empirically would have some implications for IR theory. And thirdly, recently I completed another piece on American reformers in the Cold War era. So I might briefly touch upon that. And today's lecture is based upon two of my research, which is, as Chris introduced, a book, U.S. International Lawyer in the Interwar Years, and American reformers thing is chapter 13, what a good great number, but Trajectory of American Reformers in the Cold War, Drift Toward Empire, in Martti Koskeniemi, as Empire and International Law. And I sent off the final galley last month, so which should be coming soon. Okay. So as I suggested that sort of the joy of empirical research, please allow me to little bit talk about how my own work developed. Because I had never expected when I started my research that the work would have some contribution in the field of international law. So I start, my book was based upon my PhD dissertation, and I started the work in 1991, and it was, of course, before constructivist turn, and the history of international law came to be widely sort of appreciated. Back then, I was looking for a dissertation topic, and by chance, I found the manuscripts collection of Quincy Light at the University of Chicago. And I still remember the day when I first opened the box I mean, the box was filled with many interesting kind of letters, and also his kind of memos and stuff. And still, Quincy Light has not been well researched or something. So that's the kind of the origin of that was the kind of an encounter with my Quincy Light. And back then, my original interest actually lay in exploring the Lord to Pearl Harbor. And my mentor was, back then, at the University of Chicago, was Akira Irie, who is a big scholar in international history. And he told me that you cannot contribute anything important to the origin of the Pearl Harbor, because most of the important things have been already researched. So why don't you just explore other possibilities in just the kind of the war period or the post-war period or something? But I thought there must have been something under explored, and so I just kind of sort of realized that the legal aspects leading to Pearl Harbor has not been fully explored, and I decided to work on the topic. And this is the first time for me to show this old, while I was writing a dissertation, I was just kind of playing around this thing, and I was just fancying about, or I was kind of dreaming the day, someday, if I can publish my work, I would like to use this kind of thing. But this actually illustrates what I did, because all the signatures of the important peoples, the important figures in my work. This is kind of, I mean, from the top, Eliot Root, who was a Secretary of State, and then second was James Brown Scott. He was the founder of the American Society of International Law, and Arthur Kuhn, and George A. Finch, and other international lawyers. And then the middle of the paper, James Wilford Garner. He was the teacher of Quincy Wright at the University of Illinois, and then also my favorite man, Quincy Wright. And then Mandel Hudson. He was a professor at the Harvard Law School, and he became a judge of PCIJ, Permanent Court of International Justice, and Charles Fenwick. He was a professor at Bryn Mawr College, and Edwin Borchardt, he was a Yale professor, and he had a big debate with Quincy Wright and Charles Fenwick group, and Clyde Eagleton. They were mostly international lawyers, except for Eddie Root. And then at the kind of the lower level, Henry Simpson and Corder Hall, they were two Secretary of State. And so those are the important figures in my work. And I will show you the picture of Quincy Wright. Yes. He for a long time, he taught at the University of Chicago. And what was interesting for me was that it's really hard to kind of sort of identify himself, I mean, kind of his kind of specialization. Before, in the interval periods, of course, he studied a lot about international law, but he published also works on international politics and international relations. So his research itself was very multidisciplinary. In that sense, I have been influenced by Quincy Wright himself. And this is Charles G. Fenwick in April 1939. And I think he's talking about the division of neutrality. Maybe I think of the kind of lady. So basically, what I did in my book, or originally in my dissertation, is and then biographical approach and diplomatic history, the kind of combination. Yeah. So my sources are international lawyers' letters and academic publications. Quincy Wright's papers, or Mandel Hudson papers, Edwin Borchardt's papers, and also James Wilford Garner's, or I just kind of visited those archives. on the found letters, but also their academic publications, monographs, or books, or just a kind of journal articles. And also, I had a really good opportunity to explore the papers of the American Society of International Law. And then back then, the librarian of the American Society of International Law was so kind, and it had been before the history of AIL book came out. And then when I first inquired if they had unpublished sources, the librarian said that we really don't know, but why don't you come and explore together? And we kind of explored the building of the ASIL, which is located at the Washington, D.C., and we went up to the attic together, and we just kind of explored. So that kind of sort of the moment of really, you know, kind of sort of joy in finding sources, that's still really, really kind of memorable. And also, the proceedings of the ASIL, this is a really kind of published sources. And you can, you know, even at all the major schools have those proceedings, but it records kind of really library discussions, and then most of the important sort of exchanges between the so-called reformers or traditionalists, they debate a lot, and then that can be easily kind of found in published sources such as the proceedings of the ASIL. And right now, the ASIL's kind of proceeding has become thinner, but in the interwar years, it was really kind of sort of big, kind of thick enough to contain important informations. And thirdly, of course, I explored official diplomatic documents, National Archives of the American National Archives, and also Japanese diplomatic archives. So I had thought that my contribution would lay in the addition of different interpretations concerning the law to Pearl Harbor, because Japanese scholars did not really endorse the emerging new norm, which was the outlawry of war, legal status of war should be changed. And I still believe that my greatest findings, kind of as far as the source is concerned, that the correspondence between Edwin Borchard, Yale professor, and Thomas Beatty. Thomas Beatty was a really interesting man. He was a British, but he moved to Japan, and he served for the Japanese government for quite a long time. And after the war, during the war and after the war, and he just stayed in Japan. And so there was a really kind of exchange of opinions between a Yale professor and a Japanese legal advisor. So the correspondence, the letters, were stored at the Sterling Memorial Library at Yale University. So in that sense, I identify myself as a kind of historian who is really happy about looking for sources and kind of finding new materials. And then I published Japanese version of my original dissertation in 2003. And in 2006, Japanese Association of International Law invited me to deliver a paper or deliver a talk on the role of international lawyers and their discourse. And it was my happy surprise, but I was kind of surprised, why me? Because I never thought that I would be majoring in international law. So I just wanted to write a good biography or what the international lawyers did in the interwar years. So from that time on, I started kind of sort of reading Koskenniemi, I mean, who is famous for his book, Gentle Civilizer of the Nations, which was published in 2001, and also, David Kennedy, kind of theoretical work on sort of discourse, the law of discourse in international law or something. And then Yasuaki Onuma, who is a Japanese scholar, but he talks about inter-civilization, international law or something. So in that sense, my research itself has kind of sort of developed, and then it had a kind of interesting kind of sort of consequence of the outcome. Originally, I thought, I would like to write a good biography and what they were talking about and what kind of relations international lawyers had with policymakers or something. But later, my work itself had a kind of interesting and then a kind of sort of unexpected trajectories. Okay. And now, let me move on to kind of specific, concrete part of my research. Yes. So international norm change, did it really happen? Still, we can debate about that. So legal status of war change. But Ian Brownlee, for instance, he's the author of The International Law and the Use of Force by States. He actually kind of sort of argued that the feature of the first half of the 20th century with the decisive change from a legal regime of indifference to the occasion for war II, that the substantial limitation on the competence of states to resort to force. And I told my students when I teach this topic, when the Russo-Japanese War happened in 1904, nobody kind of sort of criticized war was wrong or something. But when Japan started invasion in Manchuria, Japan was criticized, and Japan had to leave the, in the end, Japan had to withdraw from the League. So in that sense, I mean, what happened, you know, or something? So international sort of norm change or international societies kind of sort of judgment, attitude toward the war was changing. Okay. And another sort of illustrative example is Thomas Beatty's kind of sort of book. Thomas Beatty died in 1954, and his last book was entitled as International Law in Twilight. And here, it's a really kind of tiny book, and it was published by a Japanese publisher, and it was in my school's, Waseda's library. And when I found this paragraph, oh my goodness, or something, you know, and I was really happy. And then what he wrote is, it is useless to argue that the law of nations has been changed suddenly and precipitately, and that the treaties must carry consequences which their framers never intended. Who clothes Lord Wright and Professor Quincy Wright with authority to alter international law? Changes in international law cannot be affected by the opportunist declaration of a coterie of professors and journalists, however eminent they may be. And Lord Wright was a chairman of the United Nations War Crimes Committee, which was established in October 43, and then it was the origin of the Nuremberg and Tokyo War Trial. So according to Thomas Beatty, again, law of nations was changing. And then the change, in part, was, I think, derived from kind of sort of professors or international lawyers' discourse or their academic argument, as well as their kind of sort of activities. So in that sense, my book argues that there happened an international norm change from the kind of war was okay, and then, I mean, war was a kind of the sovereign right for a nation, but I mean, to a kind of to a new norm that war is not a justifiable sovereign right or something. And then, why and how it happened? Empirical findings. And the first thing is widely shared recognition that next world war should and can be avoided. Of course, after the first total war, World War I, both kind of public and also policy makers had this kind of recognition, and then they really thought that the next world war should be avoided. So it was the time of kind of sort of pacifism or the disarmament. And also secondly, or my work really kind of highlighted and kind of stressed that there was a group of reform-minded and progressive international lawyers. And they were not just ivory tower type scholars, and they were kind of activists. They gave lectures to the public, and also they wrote letters to policy makers. And then they believed that the legal status of war should be changed. So academically, of course, the academic discourse, but as I indicated in my book, their activities, you know, those things are really important. And the American scholars were the kind of the leading ones, but also progressive international lawyers or kind of reform-minded scholars, they formed a kind of transnational networks, including Nicholas Politis, who was a diplomat of, and I think he was a foreign minister of Greece, and he was a representative at the League of Nations, and also Hans Baerbock, who was a German scholar, and others such as, and also in the United Kingdom, Arnold McNair, John Fisher Williams, or later period Hirsch Lauterpacht, they exchanged, and they sometimes, you know, they participated in the discussions held at the American Society of International Law. So according to David Kennedy, there sometimes emerged a kind of heroic lawyers. And then they tried to establish a group, and they worked together and to change the kind of sort of international law or international norm. And thirdly, this is another important point. Financial support from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, International Law Division. And James Brown Scott, who was the founder and who was the president of the American Society of International Law for a long period, he was also closely involved in this, the Carnegie Endowment. So the Carnegie Endowment International Law Division sponsored to publish some important works, and also translation of classical international law works into English. And another example is a conference, which was called Conference of Teachers of International Law and Related Subjects. And this conference was held in 1914, 25, 28, 29, 41, 46, And then most of the important international lawyers participated in it, and then not just the kind of sort of academic discussions. They all seriously and actively discuss how international law should be taught to college level and sometimes, you know, high school teachers. And Quincy Light, for instance, advocated that at summer school or something, Carnegie Endowment should fund and should give funding for inviting high school teachers to study about kind of international law. So according to Quincy Light's idea, to study international law might be a source of building a kind of sort of stable international order. Yes. And Conference of Teachers of International and Related Subjects, they also have interesting kind of proceedings. I'm sure the LSE has the proceedings. It's not as thick as ASIO's kind of proceedings, but they are published sources. And quite kind of interesting. The list of participants are really interesting. Because at the first conference, the later important figure at the State Department participating in it, and who was whose kind of sort of teacher or staff and something. Mm. Those things can be traced in this kind of proceedings. And next kind of reason is public opinion. And outlawry of war movement that became really, really popular in the United States in the 1920s. And the outlawry of war, I mean, that's really kind of catchy, simple phrase. And then the original sort of idea was, in the medieval ages, dueling, you know, killing each other, kind of fighting, that was legal. But now, dueling is like, of course it's a crime. So once war becomes illegal, then war can be abolished or something. And then back in the 1920s, United States had take a kind of distance from the kind of commitment to the League of Nations or a world court. But outlawry of war did not entail any kind of concrete commitment. So this movement spread really widely, and the women's kind of a pacifist group endorsed this movement. And the leader of this movement was a wealthy corporate lawyer, Solomon Levinson. And by the John Dewey, he was a famous kind of scholar, participated in this movement. Okay. And another important aspect for Hawaii international norm change took place was policymakers' support. And Henry L. Stimson and Calder Hall, two secretaries of state, in the 1930s, they endorsed the ideas of progressive international lawyers. Oh, by the way, the term reformers and the traditionals are their own self-identifications. I cannot remember when they started using that, but at the ASIO debates or somewhere, they started, you traditionalists, you reformers or something. So there was a cooperation between policymakers and some international law scholars. And for instance, Quincy Light wrote many letters to Hall, and Hall, Calder Hall, responded to some of them. And interestingly enough, Calder Hall, he was a Secretary of State, but Calder Hall assumed the presidency of the ASIO in 1939. I thought this was a really important fact, but nobody, had ever kind of sort of noted this, because Calder, Secretary of State, but he was the president of the ASIO, and Calder Hall's presidential address was broadcasted on CBS radio station in April 1940 or something. And then he just talked about the future of international law. International law is kind of really important. And one indication up the kind of the kind of sort of lawyers' contribution and the cooperation between lawyers and the policymaker. Quincy Light's really short editorial comment, which was published in 1932. Henry Stimson issued the Stimson Doctrine after, you know, Japan started a war in Manchuria. And then Henry Stimson himself thought that, according to his diary, this was something minimal, because the United States cannot implement sanction or something. But Quincy Light wrote that this was not minimum, but this should be a really, really great innovation. Because according to Quincy Light, up to that time, international law had given legal recognition to changes affected by the use of force. But Quincy Light wrote that recognition has been the magic formula that has converted violation into legality, robbery into title, might into right. So for him, the Stimson Doctrine was not just a kind of symbolic declaration. This make a really, really great innovation in the development of international law. And also Stimson was very encouraged by Quincy Light's kind of argument. And then later, Henry Stimson, based upon Quincy Light's argument, delivered a short kind of sort of address. And then it was a small pamphlet or something, kind of brochure, and then distributed it kind of widely. Okay. And of course, institutionalization took place. The Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1928, The process of leading to the Kellogg-Briand Pact was something, you know, accidental, I mean, based upon the negotiation between France and the United States. But the progress of international lawyers debated, and they saw that we have to make out of this. And then traditionally thought that this was something dangerous, you know, just a declaration, no peace. And then, or some realists saw that this was just merely international case, just a declaration itself. But scholars such as Quincy Light and Fenwick thought that we can make this treaty something meaningful, and they kind of sort of published articles and tried to find out some kind of sort of some supportive argument for the Kellogg-Briand Pact. And of course, as you know well, the League of Nations cabinet and its practice, the verdict at the Manchurian incident or something. So there was a kind of institutional endorsement for the kind of the new norm, outlawry of war, the change of legal status of war. But the norm change process was not easy. It was not really kind of sort of smooth, or it did not happen automatically or voluntarily, because some major powers, notably Japan, challenged it. And Japan started a war in Manchuria based upon the claim of self-defense. And when Japan kind of presented its own argument, Thomas Beatty, a legal advisor to the Japanese government, he made a kind of draft, and then so Japan claimed that it was based upon the light of self-defense. And also in the United States, there was a really, really heated debate between reformers and traditionalists. And the representative scholar of traditionalists was Edwin Borchardt and John Bassett Moore. And on reformers were Quincy Light and Fenwick. So finally, of course, Japan lost the war, And then there was a kind of international military tribunals, and then norm change took place. But it was not such a easy kind of sort of process. Okay. Then I would like to briefly touch upon theoretical implications. I'm not a specialist of IR theory, but I've been teaching IR theory at my school. So nowadays they talk about kind of sort of course, norm change in kind of constructivist framework. And according to most widely read works written by Fenimore and Sikink, International Norm Dynamics and Political Change, there exist some kind of stages. Norm emergence, norm cascade, and internalization. And I came to wonder how my empirical sort of findings of interwar years and also kind of sort of part of post-war years fit with this kind of sort of norm change process. So stage one, norm emergence. And according to Fenimore and Sikink, there should be some norm entrepreneurs. And I thought this was right, yes. Solomon Levinson, Alto Rodeo Movement, and then they kind of started to claim that war should be abrogated, war should not be illegal. No, war should not be legal. So there was a kind of norm entrepreneurs. And then James T. Shotwell, he was another scholar. He was not an international lawyer, but James Shotwell, Columbia professor, he endorsed the idea. And again, as an institution, Carnegie Endowment supported this kind of sort of movement. And scholars, they were not the normal entrepreneurs. But after the norm emerged, they kind of sort of elaborated the importance of this norm in more sophisticated way in the discussion of international law. So again, Quincy Wright, Charles Fenwick, and Mandel Hardison, yes, those important scholars, they published works and tried to kind of make sense in the discussion of international law. And stage two, norm cascade. As I already kind of mentioned, yes, norm cascade happened, but there appeared a challenger. And the institutionalization, the most notable institutionalization was the Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1928. But at the very beginning, Japan was not happy about this pact. And Japan thought that if Japan should join and then Japan should endorse and ratify this pact, because if Japan does not endorse this act, Japan would be regarded as a kind of sort of outcast of international society. Because back then, Japan was a permanent member of the League of Nations Council. So, but according to one American scholar, I mean, Japan's attitude was kind of dubious, and then Japan was maybe unwillingly kind of signed the pact. Yes. But Japan started invasion in Manchuria in September 1931, and then there was a long debate at the League of Nations. Then the League of Nations sent the commission to Manchuria. And the final verdict over the Manchurian incident was what Japan did was not right. And then Japan based her own claim based on bilateral treaties between China and Japan. So the so-called unequal treaties. 1920, for instance, in 1915, there was a 21 demands or something. But the League claimed that after, in the interwar years, there were new developments, that the cabinet of the League of Nations and the Nine Power Treaties and also the Kellogg-Briand Pact, that those multilateral treaties should be more respected. So Japan should renegotiate with China based upon those multilateral treaties. And the League of Nations completely did not deny Japan's claim, because Japan had invested financially in Manchuria and China. But as far as, and also as far as Japanese kind of sort of the action and behavior starting in 1931, according to the League, that was against the Kellogg-Briand Pact. So then finally, Japan decided to withdraw from the League of Nations. And then in Japan, the most of the scholars were kind of sort of traditionalists, and then they did not really admit that the Stimson Doctrine was something innovative, or the Kellogg-Briand Pact was important. Rather, they thought that war should be regarded as sovereign rights. There was a single scholar who studied under Mandel Hudson, kind of endorsed the kind of the liberal view and the progressive view, but he was a really minority in Japan. And then when he published a short article to criticize Japanese governmental actions, he was kind of threatened by the right-wing people and stuff. Yeah. So internalization, did it really, what about the internalization? In pre-years, Japan, internalization did not take place. Policymakers, as well as the major intellectuals, challenged the emerging norm. So for them, why? Because Americans or reformers or other scholars, they claim that the international sort of norm, new norm, out the illegal status war was emerging, but is it really established one or something? Yeah. But in the United States, in international community, there were debates between reformers and traditionalists. For instance, Quincy Wright versus Boucher happened. So in the United States, then who decided, I mean, which was the kind of sort of decisive factor to determine that the kind of reformers, and which was right? And in my observation, finally, kind of policy endorsement. Cordell Hull and Stimson supported kind of sort of reformers' position. So in the United States, internalization was not a really kind of, again, easy one. But in the end, at least up until 1945 or so, or 1941, I think reformers' side was more dominant. And then post-war years, in Japan, yes, we do have constitution drafted by the United States, I mean, under the occupation period, and we have Article 9, and it claims that kind of renunciation of war. And we have the self-defense force, but we call it self-defense force, and we don't call it military. So post-war years, it seems to me that, outlawry of war or illegal status of war, that norm has been internalized. And for instance, Yasuo Ishimoto, a leading international law scholar of that time, wrote that the desire of all humankind to eliminate war led to the notion of aggression, and it changed the legal status of war. But this was published in 1958. So then what about the United States? Interestingly, this is my new work. With the light of the Cold War, Under the current of academic discussion at the ASIR started to change. And then I was so surprised to find this kind of sort of gulf or division between light and fame week. Again, I found this in the proceedings of the American Society of International Law. And in April 1950, Fenwick actually remarked, I would like to start off by a direct attack upon my friend Quincy Light, with whose views I differ radically. And so Quincy Light supported to the UN Charter, and he still kind of believed in the kind of the possibility of the UN to regulate war. But Fenwick, he was more involved in kind of Latin American affairs in post-war period. And then he just kind of supported that kind of sort of American policy of Cuban quarantine and stuff. So in the United States, there was a kind of sort of division. There happened a division between Light and Fenwick. So then, this is the kind of part of my conclusion in a chapter, a trajectory of American reformers. So for Quincy Wright, Quincy Wright found great power's attitude toward and the use of international law controversial. So he was critical of American kind of sort of sort of policy and then its claim on international law. But Fenwick justified U.S. official policy in the name of law. And Fenwick took it for granted that law itself could comprise the elements of power. So for him, international law can be imperial if necessary. But this empire would and should be trusted upon as honest and benevolent one by its subordinate. So he honestly saw that this empire would be better than kind of Soviet one in the Cold War. So the context was completely kind of international context affected upon their argument. So Fenwick believed that under American hegemonic order, people would be better off than under Soviet one. But Wright in turn believed that international law can and should boldly walk into the realm of power and serve as a tool to regulate imperial actions, in particular its use of force. And interesting, very interesting, can Quincy Wright alone, I mean, in academic discourse, you know, Quincy Wright alone is critical of kind of sort of Cuban crisis and the Cuban quarantine. And then later in the Vietnam War period, Quincy Wright and then Richard Falk, they kind of forged again interesting kind of discussion to criticize American sort of use of international law in the Vietnam War. So that was the kind of the trajectory of reformers in the post-war period. Yeah. Now I move on to kind of sort of epilogue. So in the interwar years, international norms concerning the legal status of war started to change. And the change was made possible by several factors, as I noted, and then maybe, of course, policymakers, but I would argue that international lawyers' activities and discourse were very important. And the process seemed to be completed with the UN Charter and Nuremberg and Tokyo War Tribunals, because kind of war crimes were established. However, seemingly established norms can be shaken depending upon new developments which can affect upon internalization. That's a kind of really, really big question. Because I still have to work on Quincy Wright in Vietnam War period, and then my kind of long-term project is just really, really trace Quincy Wright's argument up to his kind of sort of passing. And finally, as I highlighted in this kind of lecture, in the kind of first period, again, I would like to kind of close my lecture, sort of really, really kind of joy of doing a kind of empirical research. My mentor, EDL used to say that if you make a good empirical research, sound and deep research, and the body of your research will stay longer. And also, he himself kind of, you know, taken kind of multilateral, sort of interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary approach. So I would like to kind of sort of stress that kind of sort of underpinning theme of this lecture. So that's my conclusion. So thank you very much for your attention. And again, I'm deeply grateful to all those who have made my visit to the LSE possible, including, of course, the late Professor Heidi, as well as Professor Hughes and Sophie Weiss, who managed the logistics perfectly. Thank you very much again. Thank you very much for your attention.
Would you like to sit down for the Q&A, or you can stay standing if you
prefer?
Okay,
either way.
It's up to you if you're tired.
I may have to lie down.
Okay, thank you very much. Indeed. So we've got about half an hour for questions and answers. Would anyone like to start off with Margot? Do you want to say who you are?
Emeritus Professor of International Relations. And thank you very much for your talk. My question concerns how you interpret the difference between norm and law, because it seems to me that you're using them interchangeably. And to talk about a cascade once a law has been established, I just would like you to specify the difference.
Would you like to answer that first? And then
thank you very much. That's a very, very important question. Yeah. And for instance, according to Finemore and Sikink, norm is kind of really widely shared kind of sort of recognition, widely shared kind of sort of perception or recognition. And then for in their research, the kind of instance, a concrete example is anti-personal landmine treaty or something. So in today's lecture, so maybe I kind of used it kind of interchangeably, but as far as, and then, but in my own kind of original work, I did not use the word norm. Rather, I kind of sort of course stressed the, or focus on law, because I mostly talked about the Covenant, the League of Nations, and also the Kellogg-Briand Pact. In that sense, it's kind of sort of a kind of treaty, something really formal. Yes. And then norm is a kind of sort of, the norm is a kind of sort of more sort of new kind of, I should not say new, but the IR scholars started to use it. IR scholars like kind of sort of constructivists used, and then there's a kind of sort of intersection fields between international law and international relations, and then they kind of found that some kind of sort of loose agreement, and then in that sense, maybe norm is kind of sort of broader than law. But I fully kind of understand that today I use it kind of interchangeably, and then because I would like to draw some implications, you know, for IR theory. Yeah, but that's really, really kind of important point, and thank you very much.
Is it working? Peter Wilson. Ah, yes, that's better. Peter Wilson, Department of International Relations here at the LSE. Thank you very much for a fascinating talk. My question really concerns the nature of the norm we're talking about. Before we can inquire into how an international norm becomes established, we need to know what the norm is we're looking at. You've presented the norm as the outlawing of war. Mm-hmm. I wonder whether the norm is actually not that, even though that's the conventional formulation that is used, but the outlawing of a particular kind of war, which is aggressive war. The League of Nations Covenant didn't outlaw war in toto, and we can specify the wars that it permitted. For example, Article 16 actually sanctioned the use of force. They didn't use the term war. Sanctioned the use of force by the members of the League against a power threatening or using aggressive war. Now, this becomes interesting because at the present time, so for the last almost 100 years, even though aggressive war has been outlawed, international society has been wholly unsuccessful in defining what aggressive war is, what aggression means. So we have a position now where aggressive war, the norm is aggressive war is forbidden in international law, and there's a norm against aggressive war. But there's no agreement on what aggressive war is, what counts as an aggressive war, and what doesn't. So, and this is the point, the norm actually becomes a very weak one, not a strong one. And this is why the reality in international politics today is so far removed from the norm. If the norm is the outlawing of war, then reality is so far removed from that. If the norm is the outlawing of aggressive war, it's perhaps not so far removed, depending on what one understands by aggression. And there are many different interpretations of that. Sorry, that was rather a long point, but it is actually quite complex. But I'd be interested in your response. Thank you.
No, thank you very much for your comment. That's a really, really important comment. And then, I mean, in the interwar years, so there are some kind of sort of course, international institutional kind of efforts to define aggressive wars at the League too, right? And the Quincy Dyett himself, he tried to kind of sort of present, I cannot remember exactly, okay, this is aggressive war, like a three stage or something. But then back then, they were not successful. So in that sense, outlawing of war movement is something more kind of societal thing. Societal and kind of social or something. And then Kellogg-Briand Pact, when the policymakers, the Kellogg, Secretary of State, thought now that the movement was widespread, so we should do something or something. And then so, but what I wanted to stress for the interwar years is that still kind of that kind of social backup in a sense. And maybe it was not law, yeah. But contemporary period, it's completely kind of different. You know, if we look at the kind of U.S. situation, I mean, Obama's kind of sort of Nobel Peace Prize address, he talked about war sometimes can be justifiable something. So in that sense, again, it's related to Professor kind of Light's comment, you know. So we really have to, of course, differentiate kind of sort of norm and law, in international law. But again, yes, I agree that the kind of sort of aggressive war, do we have agreed norm right now? I would say perhaps not, maybe not. And then in the interwar years, maybe they were not really clear about, you know, sort of, I mean, professionals are clear about, they kind of recognize the problem. But public, as of course, then we have to go back to E.H. Carr or George Kennan's argument. They were too naive and then just thought that the treaty can, the legal agreement can somehow can be helpful to eradicate war, something.
Any other questions? I wanted to ask about the Tokyo Tribunal, because you mentioned that, and, you know, I read through, we've got the transcripts in the library here, the Tokyo Tribunal, and, you know, what was the discussion amongst the US lawyers about the Tokyo Tribunal? Because, of course, you know, the legal foundations of the tribunal are shaky, and, of course, the lawyer who questioned it most of all was the Indian lawyer, Justice Pal, who was on the tribunal. And it's really interesting to read, you know, the transcript of his intervention and what he said about how this had absolutely no basis. This is from an Indian perspective, no basis in international law at all. So I was just wondering if there was some discussion in the US about some controversy over the status of the tribunals.
Quincy Wright was involved in kind of planning stage of Nuremberg war trial. And then he kind of sort of published an article to justify it. So there was a debate in the United States. But as you kind of mentioned, Judge Powell, in Tokyo war tribunal, Japanese actually judge presented the argument that we did not know that the legal status of war had been changing. So that itself was an issue of Tokyo War Tribunal. And then we really can't, perhaps I would argue that both tribunals was in part political, of course. I mean, kind of sort of the victor's kind of justice in a sense. And then also maybe it was based upon Western idea of international law. However, if we take a kind of long-term historical sort of development leading to ICC or kind of war crime stuff, maybe it was a cornerstone to make what is the legal concept of war crime should be. I'm not sure if I answered the question correctly or not, but it's really true that there was a debate, and it's interesting that you not kind of justice. Judge Powell, Indian Powell. And then Indian Judge Powell's argument became a kind of sort of excuse, you know, for Japan, right? So and it's kind of based upon, it became a base for Japanese kind of sort of rightists and nationalists. Tokyo War Tribunal was, baseless. And then it was really kind of based upon Western ideas, and then just kind of victors just kind of enforced their ideas. But still that kind of sort of lingers in Japanese society. I mean, what we did was really kind of long, and then the notion of aggression was completely established in 1931, 39, 41. And then Japanese still think that, Judge Powell argued, okay? Internationally, it was baseless.
Retrospective.
Retrospective.
It just seemed, you mentioned the Japanese lawyer, I can't remember his name, at Tokyo, and if you read the transcript of the tribunals, it's very interesting where you do see power against law in a sense, because the Japanese lawyer was making legal arguments which were very rational, whether you agree with them or not. But the chairman of the tribunal was kind of saying, just shut up. You read it. He was more or less saying, we haven't got time for this. When you mentioned, I think it was Fenwick, and the justification of kind of American power through law as well. It's that, and then the Japanese right wing using Judge Powell's intervention. Ultimately, law is taken up by political actors and used as a kind of weapon. You know, it's almost impossible for it to be used as law. Does that make sense?
Yes, I agree. I agree because one thing, this is something I need to explore more. And then can law can be neutral? No. Right? Because of the out, kind of, so the, if kind of the kind of so the legal status of war changed, yes, kind of sort of it was backed by the US and the Western powers. So in that sense, kind of sort of always kind of sort of, you know, international law, it's been developing, backed by most powerful Western states. That's why professors like Yasuaki Onuma talks that kind of international law should be more inter-civilizational or something or something. Or, but on the other hand, if we kind of sort of look at kind of sort of humanitarian kind of sort of principles or something, I wrote in the conclusion of my book, their contribution, the reformers' contribution does not just lie in kind of sort of the legal status of war or something. They try to introduce more humanitarian, more liberal sort of approach to international law, just not the law between states, but this argument has to go back to Lazar Francis Oppenheim. The international law, or kind of maybe English school argument, sort of, there should be a kind of sort of international society. That's why they kind of sort of stress that the value of multilateral treaty more than bilateral treaties. So they thought that there should exist a kind of international society, and then international society should have one kind of sort of legal kind of treaty or code or something.
Okay, thank you. Yes. Please, microphone, yeah, this just coming.
Thank you. I'm not an IR specialist, but I'd like to challenge you on a few things, if I may, Professor Shinohara. Thank you for your talk. You talked about the Nuremberg and Tokyo tribunals, but in fact they were slightly separate, weren't they? Because the Nuremberg tribunal was about not just war crimes, but crimes against humanity. Whereas the Tokyo trials were in fact inconclusive. In particular, the fact that those who were responsible for Unit 731, particularly Ito, were never actually brought to justice and were never punished. And nothing ever happened to the very serious crimes which they committed. I would challenge your argument generally that international norms actually started in the started to change. I would argue that they actually started to change before the First World War with the Hague and Geneva Conventions, which you haven't referred to at all. The other question is that, of course, these norms, if to the extent they existed, were honored in the breach, in particular in the Spanish Civil War and Ethiopia and so on. But there's another issue, which is that there were sanctions, mm-hmm. which were applied in some cases but not others, and some sanctions were actually a provocation or a prelude to war. It has been argued by some. I'm not saying that I agree with it. It has been argued that Japan was forced into war because of sanctions. So could you comment on those issues, please?
So the first point was the difference between Nuremberg and Tokyo War Tribunals. But both are kind of also, in Tokyo War Tribunals, I could be wrong, but it was also, based upon the idea of, crime against humanity too. So, and then second point was, what was the third one was kind of sanctions, right?
First, second was about the Hague. It began before World War One.
Oh, sure. Okay. Okay. Before World War One, too, of course, the Hague conferences, and then the kind of treatment of war prisoners of how to, and also Hague conventions. That is kind of more kind of particular of thing, but the international lawyers in my research in my book. Of course, they recognize that, but they try to kind of sort of establish something kind of overarching, kind of sort of law or law of nation, law of international society. So the changing was, of course, had been happening before too. And so maybe in my book I wrote that it's really hard to decide when the change started. Maybe in that sense it was more gradual. Yeah. Or according to other scholars, right now I can't remember, but the other scholars still think that it was even after the even after 1919 and 1914, maybe international law was a kind of tool for imperial powers or something. There are like different interpretations. But again, yes, 1907 and 1898, and the two Hague conferences, those were really important too. And today I didn't really talk about judicial approach, but James Brown Scott, he was an advocate of, juridical approach or something. So in that sense, there was another current too. And sanctions, yes. Quincy Light, he endorsed the idea about sanctions, but about the Manchurian incident took place. Most of the scholars, they thought that the American government would not take the measure. Because sanctions would be a kind of military. But according to Mandel Hudson, that was a kind of interesting remark. He said something like this: okay, now war conducted by a single state is war, but sanction, if conducted by kind of multilateral powers, we need another name or something. So they started to recognize differences between warfare started by just one state against another, or sanctioned by the League of Nations, the United Nations. So and then in the late 1930s, they were starting these discussions. And then while the draft of the UN Charter, when the United States and then and Great Britain started to draft UN sort of charters, they also exchanged kind of the opinions and stuff. I cannot remember the details of how they kind of sort of recognized the sanction aspect.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions? I think maybe we should let you rest now, because I know you weren't feeling too well. Well, I'd just like to thank you very much
indeed for
a wonderful talk, and I highly recommend the book. I mean, the questions are as important now as ever, of course, and the debate goes on. So thank you very much indeed, and let me remind you that you're all welcome to come to the fifth floor for a glass of wine. There's a reception up there, so you can... If you can talk, you can carry on the discussion up there. But let's all move up to the fifth floor then, and thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you very much for your attention.